So much is going on in this planet, in this country right now. People are upside down. Sometimes they don't even know where they're headed. I thought it'd be a great time to bring in Daniel Pinchbeck to maybe put us back on course. His latest work, How Soon Is Now? It's about personal initiation to global transformation. We've got lots to talk with him about in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Daniel Pinchbeck back with us. Daniel, of course, is a New York Times best-selling author of a number of books, including 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, The Breaking Open the Head. His articles have been featured in the New York Times Magazine, Esquire, Rolling Stone, Artform, the New York Times Book Review, The Village Voice. He's been all over. He has had programs on the Gaia Television Network as well. They're still available for you to watch. We're talking about his latest work called How Soon Is Enough, which is, Daniel, an interesting title. Tell me about that, and welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Actually, the title is How Soon Is Now.
And tell me about that.
Well, I guess the idea is that, I think underlying, we have an underlying realized sense that there's something wrong with our system. You know, and we can see what's happening ecologically and so on, and we're sort of suppressing kind of the need to kind of address, you know, maybe the underlying problems that are facing us. And I think that, yeah, like now would come when we break through kind of like the distractions and so on and kind of obstructions of our current system and actually kind of deal with the causes and the base level, situation that we have to deal with.
You're in Europe right now. Are you noticing any kind of tension or a different look at the United States as we have had in the past?
Absolutely. I mean, people are very concerned about the direction of the United States. I mean, I'm in Germany right now, and to be honest, you know, people do see a lot of parallels to the rise of fascism in the 30s and so on. There's a great deal of concern about America's direction.
That's frightening, isn't it?
It is frightening, yes. So part of what's happening, I mean, obviously Trump is appointing, you know, climate deniers. And one of the basic ideas of this book is that actually the first thing that we need to recognize is, you know, we are actually in an ecological crisis that threatens our descendants, even our own future capacity to live on the planet. And at some point, we're going to have to kind of deal with that and think about the types of changes that we need to make, you know, to our systems, you know, both technical systems like industry and energy and farming, and then also our social systems, our political and economic system that go beyond kind of like simple reforms that can happen within this like two-party system.
Do you think we ever will get to that point and do that and fix some of these issues, or are we going to just continue on the same path until we run everything into the ground?
Well, that's a choice. I mean, one of the, you know, the book How Soon Is Now has a few, you know, kind of basic ideas. And one of the ideas is that, whatever we want, I mean, the ecological situation is kind of like a rite of passage or an initiation for humanity, that ultimately, whether it takes 5 years or 500 years or 50 years, we're going to have to make a transition if we're going to survive as a species from adolescence, from immaturity, from, as you said, running everything into the ground, to taking responsibility to become sort of like stewards of the community of life, which is more kind of like how the indigenous people saw things. So in some blink of an eye of time, whether it's 5 years or 50 years or even 500 years, we're going to have to make that shift from immaturity to responsibility, which is really what initiation is all about. So in a sense, I think we can look at the ecological crisis positively as humanity's collective initiation.
You have been in the past on this program with us, and you've been an expert on psychedelics, shamanism. One of your first books, Breaking Open the Head, came out, 15, 20 years ago almost?
Yeah, it came out in 2002.
And yeah. It really, I think, opened up the door for a lot of people, opened up everybody's eyes as well. Are you noticing a change in that direction? I mean, some states are approving the use of marijuana, for example. Who thought that was going to happen 10 years ago?
Yeah, well, I wrote my first book, you know, back in the late 90s and the early 2000 time, you know, I went through an existential crisis. I felt very depressed, and I was a scientific materialist. I assumed that consciousness was just embedded in the brain, and that was it. And after you die, everything is out, lights out. But I felt this gnawing sense that I needed to discover for myself. So I went on a quest to visit tribal people. I went to West Africa. I went through initiation in a country called Gabon using a substance called Iboga, I-B-O-G-A, which is actually now being used as a treatment for addictions, for heroin addiction and so on, under the name of Ibogaine, and having a lot of success in that way. I visited a tribe in Ecuador and worked with a substance called ayahuasca, which has become very popular. And yeah, so over the years, you know, it's been amazing since that book came out. And at that point, you know, you couldn't even talk about this stuff in the mainstream. There's been a huge change in how our culture is thinking about this stuff. And the New Yorker is having big articles about psychedelic therapy. There's research projects all around the world. And actually, the kinds of positive discoveries they're making about psychedelics as healing agents are really remarkable. You know, whether it's, you know, using psilocybin to treat, you know, anxiety from people who are suffering terminal illnesses, you know, LSD to treat depression, or MDMA to treat post-traumatic stress disorder in veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. They're really discovering incredible things.
Daniel Pinchbeck with us. His latest book, How Soon Is Now? And his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Are we running out of time, Daniel, to fix some of these things?
Yes. I mean, we're definitely hitting. I mean, we're losing 150 to 200 species a day is the estimate. And you know, that's because we're deforesting. We're kind of like plowing through a lot of the most biodiverse places in the planet. And I think they say there's about 8.2 million species estimated on the whole Earth. So if you do the math, it means that we're losing 10% of the Earth's remaining biodiversity every 10 to 15 years. And, you know, I know a lot of people are skeptics around climate change. I mean, personally, you know, I was open to skepticism. When I did a lot of research, I really did become convinced that, you know, it's legitimate. You know, I mean, New York is way warmer in the winters than it ever was, you know, and so on. And you know, we know that, you know, there's now more than 400 parts per million of carbon CO2 in the atmosphere. And the last time there was this much CO2 in the air, you know, sea levels were 100 feet higher and temperatures were 4 degrees Celsius warmer. So that's the direction we're heading. And we also know there are these kind of feedback loops in the system that when they get engaged can become quite irreversible. You know, so forest fires lead to more droughts and more forest fires and more loss of carbon. So yeah, I mean, we really are at a you know, crucial threshold where we need to do exactly the opposite of what, you know, the Trump administration is pushing us towards, and rethink our relationship to the ecology as a whole, and actually redesign our society so we mesh with the ecology that surrounds us.
I'm in Los Angeles right now, and we've gone from what was a drought situation to now they have severe flooding. They were concerned about a dam breaking. They evacuated 200,000 homes. It just seems like the planet is topsy-turvy.
The planet is definitely topsy-turvy. I mean, you know, this is a very, I mean, this industrial civilization is an experiment. It's only been going on for a few hundred years. I mean, 250 years ago, you know, we were riding horse and buggies, and we didn't have electricity, let alone, you know, email and so on. So, you know, we've had this huge push. You know, we discovered these incredible fossil fuel reserves. I mean, I think one barrel of oil is like 23,000 man hours of work. I mean, it's something incredible like that. You know, so we had this bequest from you know, the Earth to build this global civilization. And now we have to step back, you know, and once again, it's kind of the opposite of what's happening in our public sphere. We have to think about the direction that we're going, and we have to think about how do we create an enduring, you know, system, that is sort of regenerative system that will protect not only the whole humanity, like the whole human family, but also the community of life that supports us, you know. And so it's a different mindset, and that's what How Soon Is Now seeks to develop, both theoretically and then kind of practically.
Daniel, if you could wave a magic wand and fix something right now, what would that be?
Well, I mean, what would I fix?
If you had the ability to just change anything you could on this planet, what would be the first thing you'd tackle?
That's interesting. Well, I think that, you know, it's, you know, there's so many things, right? I mean, you know, first of all, we need to go from where we are now to 100% renewable energy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we can't do that over, you know, 100, 150 years. We have to accelerate the time scale. So we have to do that over 5 or 10 or 15 years, you know, maybe 20 years, you know, which is physically possible. There's nothing preventing us. So I think the first thing is that we need to have, like, almost like a, like, you know, like, we look at what happened with the U.S., you know, after Pearl Harbor, in just a few months, we changed all of our industry for wartime production, and we taxed the wealthy at, you know, 94% or something, and we funneled all the resources into defeating, you know, the Nazis and the war effort. You know, when we see what's happening to the global, you know, the natural environment on the planet, we need a similar kind of mass effort of human society. I mean, it has to be a voluntary effort, I think. I don't think it can be compulsive. So the question is, I guess, in a way, could we use systems we have like the internet to, you know, help people learn and understand what's happening and then organize, you know, communities that that are making these types of changes.
You got Sting to write the preface for your book. How did that happen?
Sting has been a fan, I guess, an admirer of my work. He once called me his favorite philosopher. he loved Breaking Open the Head, and he gave me a beautiful quote for 2012. And I've gotten a beautiful opportunity to hang out with him. I've visited him, you know, in his different homes in Italy and England. And we once flew across the crop circles in England in a helicopter. So, yeah, he's a friend. And also Russell Brand, kind of the controversial English comedian and performer,
right,
wrote an introduction for the book, which was sweet.
They seem to be believers in your philosophies. And they seem to feel, as if you do, that the clock is ticking and ticking very fast.
Yeah, I don't think it's you know, we don't have to believe that. I mean, it's quite, you know, once again, if we think about losing 10% of the Earth's remaining biodiversity every 10 to 15 years, we can't, you know, and we understand now how meshed together the web of life is on the planet, right? Like, if we lose the bees who are, you know, collapsing on us, or the butterflies, you know, we lose their services.
Yeah, that's right.
Pollinating and so on. You know, we know that, I mean, the UN, according to the UN, we have 60 years of farming harvests with current agricultural practices, because our industrial monoculture agriculture depletes topsoil. You know, so on the other hand, there are lots of practices, you know, they're called regenerative farming practices, like no-till and organic and permaculture, that actually make the soil better and replenish soil. You know, so you know, we have to sort of stop on it somehow or other, and maybe this Trump administration, you know, will precipitate, you know, the crisis that's necessary for us to come to our senses. You know, we have to recognize that we have to change our direction, you know, on a much bigger way and a deeper way. You know, so the book really looks at those alternatives. You know,
Daniel, why are people so uptight these days? I mean, I have noticed this. And it's far worse than at any time I can remember.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like uptight. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, like, it's just that, you know, they don't have patience anymore. They don't have manners anymore. Everything is me, 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 me. Seems like we've lost something.
I mean, I think what we've seen, you know, with this election, is kind of the you know, the new technologies always have like a light side and a shadow side, and now we're suddenly seeing a lot of the shadow sides of the internet, for instance, you know, stuff that we didn't really address, you know, like the trolling culture, and you know, these massive
and the haters and things like that,
where people who are frustrated in their lives now feel they have this freedom to hate, you know, and be misogynist and bigoted and racist and, you know, angry and attack other people and so on. And unfortunately, you know, Trump, as kind of like an empty vessel, you know, for the collective, you know, was willing to kind of feed off of that kind of new tone of contempt and kind of give it a public face. You know, so but hopefully it's like a necessary, you know, kind of eruption. You know, I mean, I look at things, you know, from the 2012 book and the book on shamanism. You know, I really take Carl Jung's ideas really seriously, and I feel there is like a, you know, collective unconscious and archetypes that move through the collective psyche. And in a way, we're going through a period of like these archetypal forces from the collective psyche, you know, that we haven't really seen, you know, for many years are showing up. And maybe that's necessary, so we recognize them, you know, as our own projections, in a sense.
Since you started writing, have you seen a change for the better or the worse?
Since I started writing in general?
Uh-huh.
Well, I've seen many changes for the better that have astonished me. I mean, I, you know, and I think that there are many ways we can see that things have gotten better, but it's also, you know, very complicated. I mean, for instance, the openness to, you know, the visionary experience in the West, you know, through psychedelics, but also meditation and so on. Like, many people are having, kind of pursuing a path of awakening, which is extraordinary. And then also, I mean, as I write in the book, like, I think, the evolution of the internet is amazing. I mean, one idea that I, you know, that I've looked into is this idea of, like, you know, a global brain, that humanity is almost on the cusp of realizing, you know, that we have a kind of global brain through the internet, where we're able to exchange ideas and new technologies and tools, you know, kind of instantly. And, you know, in the kind of crisis that we're already facing, it's going to get worse over the next years, the fact that we're able to connect like that may have crucial importance.
You talk a little bit about the design scientist Buckminster Fuller. You seem to admire his work. He is good at what he had done. Tell me why he has been included in your work.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, what I felt in the need in this new book to come up with a kind of systems theory perspective. So I think we tend to get lost in the weeds a little bit, and sometimes you need to step way back and almost look at the whole system, almost like an extraterrestrial, you know, might from another planet or something. And Buckminster Fuller was a comprehensive systems thinker. He was a design scientist. I mean, he was a very interesting person. He was in his early 30s. He had an existential crisis after a daughter had died. He thought of committing suicide. Then he said, no, instead of killing myself, I'm going to choose to dedicate my life to having the biggest possible impact on humanity as a whole. You know, and he developed a whole, you know, mathematical system. He noted that there was something wrong in the way we were designing and building, that we were sort of trying to dominate and control nature's processes. This was having negative effects, and instead we should be learning from nature and kind of imitating their processes. He wrote a number of amazing books in the 60s that are short and easy to read. One is called Utopia or Oblivion. And back then he really realized already that we had the technical resources and the capacity to make a world that worked for everybody, where everybody had a decent way of life and every human being, you know, could look forward to, you know, a decent way of life. But we couldn't do it under the current ideology, the current political and economic system. So he argued that we needed kind of like what he called the design revolution. He's just a beautiful thinker. I mean, he noted that it's crazy that we design with right angles, like everything is squares and boxes.
Mm-hmm. He changed that.
Right. What's that?
He changed that, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he created things like the geodesic dome, you know, these domes that are used in festivals and so on now that are built on triangles. I mean, you know, he made a major contribution, but also his manner of thinking, this idea that we should learn from nature's processes rather than always trying to dominate or control is I think, really, really important right now.
Daniel Pinchbeck with us, of course, his latest book, How Soon Is Now? Where do you get the book, by the way, Daniel?
Well, the book actually is still on its way to bookstores, but you can certainly order it already from Amazon or Barnes & Noble's or your local bookstore.
God, it's coming out soon, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in the UK, Amazon, you can probably already get a Kindle edition, too, if you want.
And what gets you out there in Germany? What are you up to out there?
I'm actually giving workshops around the book. The book just got translated into German. And, I'm just talking to people about it, and it feels good to be here.
You have talked about how we need to change industry, farming. But I don't see the clean thinkers coming up with anything original. Do you?
Yeah, there's absolutely tremendous thinkers who come up with all sorts of great things. I mean, for instance, in my book, I talk about William McDonoghue, a designer who wrote a book called Cradle to Cradle. And for instance, in that book, like, you know, we're in this pessimistic mindset where we don't think things can get better. But he notes that actually, you know, we could redesign our industrial systems so they feed back positively.
Hold on for a second, Daniel. We're at the break, but we'll come back for more. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Daniel Pinchbeck with us. His latest book, How Soon Is Now? It's a great book, by the way. It's well laid out, Daniel, and it's printed perfectly. I mean, I like the papers and the design and everything. You and your publisher did a great job with this.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we had fun thinking that out. So, yeah, I really like it also.
You have a section of several chapters that have to do with God, love, and revolution. Let's talk about that for a moment. And your thoughts these days about the God. A lot of people are changing their views these times. I don't think people are as religious as they used to be or spiritual. What's happening? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, once again, I mean, I was a, you know, total secular, you know, materialist until I explored shamanism, and I had so many incredible experiences that seemed to reveal that there were these much larger dimensions of the psyche, of consciousness, and so on. And I had to give that a lot of thought, and it ultimately really shifted my worldview. And what I began to realize is that all around the world there are esoteric, mystical paths, you know, whether it's like, you know, shamanism or, you know, alchemy, Gnosticism, Sufism, you know, Kabbalah and so on. And actually, you know, if you get into these paths, they all kind of work together. They kind of correlate. And it's really the religions are the problem, because the religions are more about creating these kind of moral doctrines and indoctrinating, you know, huge masses of people just to follow blindly, you know. So I make a big distinction between kind of initiation as a path and indoctrination. And the idea of initiation is, you know, people go through their own self-discovery journey to you know, open the door for themselves, you know, as Christ says in the Gnostic Gospels, you know. And so, yeah, so I think that, like, you know, I feel comfortable talking about, I would say, God or universal consciousness, or that, you know, and also now we know from, you know, quantum physics that, you know, there, it seems like there's kind of an underlying consciousness that, that, you know, kind of permeates, you know. There are all sorts of different ways we can talk about what's happening. But what the exciting thing, though, is I think when we kind of break through to this type of understanding, it kind of allows us also to break through some of the divisions between religions. I mean, it's pretty amazing to me, for instance, that Pope Francis has been one of the people to step forward and make a truly beautiful plea to humanity about the ecological crisis, and particularly a plea to the developed world. You know, he wrote an essay called "Care for a Common Home," where he basically argues that we need like a new religious movement towards replenishing and restoring the Earth's ecosystems, and that this is something that, you know, Catholics should see as their own kind of responsibility, like a sacred responsibility. So, yeah, I really do see there's the opportunity to mesh together, you know, people who've been on this kind of mystical path, the broader religious movements, and that, you know, caring for our common home would be one basis for that.
Where does the Dalai Lama fit in here?
I mean, I'm a huge fan. I mean, I think Tibetan Buddhism is fascinating. You know, I think that this Eastern mysticism, you know, is something that, you know, many people are gravitating to. And you know, but I sometimes think that the way, like, the sort of liberal elite culture has taken on, you know, mysticism has been a little bit insular and has led to kind of like an apolitical kind of thing. You know, where actually my idea is that you know, politics and spirituality and ecology really need to go together and be understood.
Sure.
Like, you know, if you have this awakening, then you also have you know, you should be of service to the world as best you can.
When I ever think of the elitists, Daniel, I think of the movie Eyes Wide Shut, and that lifestyle and that control and everything that they think is right about what they do. They're out there, aren't they?
Well, I mean, there's different subsets of elites. I mean, you know, I think once again, not to get too deep into the whole Trump situation, but I mean, you know, they're also a very self-serving, you know, elite who, you know, are now, you know, going against everything that they said in during the campaign in terms of, like, working closely with Wall Street and the corporate interests. You know, so I think it's very much betraying, you know, the common person, you know, for the interests of a very small wealthy elite. You know, and what I said about love in the book is, and this is complicated in a sense. I mean, you know, I visited a number of times this community in Portugal called Tamara, which has tried to create kind of a new social design around love and relationships. I mean, you know, one thing, like, if we look at the last election, you know, sexuality was a big underlying issue, you know, whether it was Trump, you know, his interactions with past women and, you know, what he said about grabbing the you-know-what, you know, or Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton as a philanderer, you know, or Roger Ailes, who ran Fox News, mm-hmm. who went down in a massive sex scandal. You know, there seems to be this underlying thing where you have, like, alpha males who seek power partially to, you know, ensure sexual access for themselves, you know, wealth and power. And in that type of system, you know, it leads to this kind of domination and negativity and cynicism. Sure. And so on. So the question is, you know, could we create a different, sort of a different social design to create a different culture around love and sexuality, and recognizing that, you know, while, you know, many people are monogamous and are happy in monogamous partnerships, you know, other people, you know, end up cheating or having serial monogamy or whatever. You know, so Tamara tried to create a social design. It's a community of about 170 people that's based on non-possessive, transparent relationships that are rooted in trust. And yeah, it's quite amazing. Like all the children are raised, by the community as a whole. So women are, who have children in the community are free of the concern they're going to be stuck for life, taking care of one child or whatever. And that many people have multi-partner relationships, but everybody knows what's happening with everybody else. And when jealousy comes up, they have kind of public forums to mediate it. And the idea of Tamara, the founder, is that these core issues around love and eros and sexuality are deep political issues that our society hasn't had the consciousness yet to address.
How are people handling these kinds of situations around the planet outside of the United States? I mean, are they all together? I mean, do they have their act together?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Well, I mean, other nations, I mean, don't they have the same kind of issues and problems we have, or are they tackling their things differently?
In terms of sexuality?
Everything. Industrial use, pollution.
America is a younger country. I mean, I think there's different attitudes in Europe, and apparently in France it's almost accepted that major political figures will have like mistresses and so on. Every culture has a different way of dealing with it. But America, is where we're from, and it has a number of factors happening. It has a kind of puritanical, repressive kind of background. Then it has a very like hedonistic, licentious culture, from like MTV to Studio 54, Spring Break and all that stuff. So, we have to kind of, deal with, the chaos in our society. But yeah, we can look to these other cultures in a way for more elegant models,
Are people more psychically inclined today than they were a few years ago?
So that's a big subject in my work. I mean, let me just step back. Like one of the main ideas of How Soon Is Now is that this ecological crisis is kind of like a rite of passage or initiation for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And initiations traditionally in tribal societies, people would go into visionary states or have psychic or transpersonal experiences, whether through visionary plants or fasting or walkabout or some kind of extreme circumstance, And I do think that, the modern civilization repressed this idea of psychic abilities, so scientific materialists don't think that we have them. But, I've had many psychic experiences, as have many friends of mine. So I do think that, we're beginning to become more aware that there is this kind of field of the psyche or there's psi energy that operates in different ways. And I think that might be very important in the future. I mean, it's something we also see in all of our films, right, like The Matrix or Avatar or Star Wars. It's always about going through a training, going through an initiation to be able to use the force or the power, or the matrix or whatever. So yeah, I mean, I think in the future we'll actually realize that we do have these psychic capacities and we'll actually seek to make use of them, to train them and so on. I mean, this one researcher, Dean Radin, has suggested that we're at the development of psychic power, kind of where we were with electricity in the late 18th century. People see that it's powerful, but we don't really know how to store it or to transmit it or what to do with it. Once we figured out electricity, then in 150 years, we created this massive society that we have now. We had a geophysical effect on the Earth as a whole system. So we don't actually know what we could do with psychic energy if we were able to make use of it.
People are talking about money is going to be passé. Everything will be electronic and digital. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, what I discuss in How Soon Is Now is that the economic system is a major problem, because the system we have now is debt-based. It forces competition, artificial scarcity. It automatically creates winners and losers, and it also, has created, more and more hoarding. So capital has amassed as you go up the pyramid until I think it's like 8 people now have more wealth than 50% of the Earth's population. I mean, Trump's, cabinet, I think, is, the 17 people have more wealth than one-third of America. You know, so this incredible concentration of energy has happened, and I think that's very destructive, you know, for humanity as a whole, and needs to be addressed with a new approach to, you know, how we exchange value. I mean, money is an instrument for exchanging value, and one thing I look at in the book are different concepts or models for how we could change the money system. One of them comes from a Belgian economist, Bernard Lyotard, who wrote a book called The Future of Money. And he proposes that, you know, there are different types of currencies that he studied through history, and some of them have like masculine, aggressive values and behavior patterns built into them, and those are yang currencies. You know, yang is the Taoist idea of like masculine, you know, aggressive energy. You know, and then there are yin currencies, which is feminine, kind of collaborative, communal. You know, there have been a lot of yin currencies through history also, but the only currency we have is a monoculture of a yang currency. You know, something that, you know, it has interest and is debt-based and forces competition. So he proposes new currencies are necessary to balance this out. So, for instance, he suggests one called the Terra, which would be a negative interest currency. It would be a global trading currency that has a demurrage charge. So it actually loses value when you try to hold on to it. So instead of trying to hoard it, you're best off getting it back into circulation. And if we look at kind of, you know, a metaphor of humanity as a whole kind of being like a giant organism, like a planetary body, a superorganism, you know, we could look at our own bodies, like money, you know, energy is not hoarded by certain cells in the body. It's distributed wherever it needs to go. You know, so at the moment we have these kind of obstructions where the energy is being hoarded by certain groups, by certain elites and so on, whereas we need to circulate resources, you know, in a better fashion.
Okay, let's take a few calls here before we go to more calls next hour. Lillian is in Saskatchewan, Canada, on the international line. Hello, Lillian. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, go ahead, hon.
Hi. A couple of questions. The farming, I'd like to focus on that again, the GMOs. And also, James Cameron is talking a lot about you can't eat meat or dairy and be an environmentalist. 91% of the lungs are being eaten up by the beef industry down in Brazil, all obliterated by the meat industry. Could you say something about that?
Yes, for sure. So it's estimated that you know, industrial agriculture is responsible for 30% of more of CO2. Release, and the biggest contributor is meat eating, and particularly factory farming. So yeah, the biggest positive impact that we can all easily have on the planet is to reduce or to eliminate meat consumption. You know, that's obviously not a very popular idea right now. But, you know, not only is factory farming producing methane and CO2 and so on, it also is, you know, animal agriculture is responsible for a lot of deforestation, building these huge soybean plantations in the Amazon, as Cameron said. And, you know, apparently 30% of the Earth's surface is animal grazing land. You know, we're losing the world's forests, but if we were to, you know, radically curtail the animal grazing land by not having, you know, not using so many animals, you know, we could then reforest that land, and those areas would become carbon sinks, you know, which would be awesome. So yeah, I mean, he's absolutely correct. And yeah, so and essentially they've done studies that, you know, with different practices like no-till agriculture, you know, rather than tilling the field, you do it in a different way, mm-hmm. that allows for the CO2 to be to you know, stay in the soil and be replenished. I mean, there's a lot of techniques that could be scaled up globally. I mean, another very interesting one is biochar, you know, which comes from the Amazon basin, where they discovered that the tribal people were actually kind of increasing the fertility of the jungle by doing this kind of slow burning process with organic mass that then led to this kind of carbon-rich tilth, which they could sprinkle over the jungle. And, you know, so now there are biochar, industrial biochar, where you're, you know, creating energy by building, by burning organic mass in this way that then that doesn't release the carbon, but allows it to then be replenish the soil. You know, so there are a lot of techniques that already exist in programs. The problem is, because of the obstructions in our political and economic system and our media, frankly, they haven't been brought to public consciousness or recognized as you know, movements that need to happen very quickly.
Daniel, are you confident that these changes that we've been talking about tonight are going to happen?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, that's you know, that, I believe that, as I said, I believe that ultimately they will, because ultimately we're going to want to survive on the planet. And but at the moment, we definitely have forces working against us. I mean, the media is insane. You know, Fox or CNN, like what they put out all the time, you know, has nothing to do with our ability to thrive as a species on the planet. And that's where we need to be focusing, you know, and then, you know, I mean, it looks likely that you know, the sort of Trump team, you know, is going to push us towards another war. I mean, that's, you know, that's an ecologically devastating prospect at this point. I mean, we are, you know, peak oil was not as extreme as you know, it was advertised to be a few years ago, because they found more unconventional sources of oil and energy. But even so, the cost of producing, you know, traditional energy is growing a lot. And in fact, you know, renewables have already reached kind of grid parity in many cases. But that cost of energy increasing is going to make it, you know, harder and harder for us to make this rapid transition that we need to make, which is another reason why it would be better for us to start doing it sooner rather than waiting till, you know, very, very critical threshold is hit.
And we've got the knowledge to do this. We've got the knowledge to make the change.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so the, you know, but the thing is that it requires, I mean, what I suggest in the book is that the alternative to what we have now would be a kind of post-capitalist system. You know, like you know, so what, you know, Trump, for instance, has said that he's going to bring all these manufacturing industrial jobs back, but we know that's not the case. In fact, everything's going in the direction of automation, right? Like, we now have self-driving, you know, vehicles. You know, there's 3.5 million truck drivers in the U.S. Like, in 5 years, those jobs aren't going to exist, you know, probably. You know, so what are we going to do with all the people? Well, either you can do what they seem to want to do, which is cut their education, cut their health care, distribute, you know, guns and hope they wipe themselves out or something. You know, I don't know. Or you can say, okay, we need a different model. We need to create regenerative systems, resilient communities, have a basic income. You know, people are kind of subsidized to, you know, grow some of their own food, live in multi-generational communities, not work so hard, you know, cultivate.
Hold on, Daniel. We're at the top of the hour, but we're coming back for another hour of phone calls next.